Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. Hopefully everyone had a pleasant and restful or active afternoon, whichever your preference is. I went, by my count, 47 minutes this morning. That's a little long for me. I'm going to try to give you a little bit of time back this evening. That being said, I'm going to put that at risk by rambling a little bit here to begin with. I'm not a big fan of negative preaching versus positive preaching. I don't really believe in that dichotomy, especially. I think that most people, when they say negative preaching, they mean talking about sin. And they may not be a big fan of that because they don't like thinking about sin. I understand that. But most, in fact, pretty much every Christian I've ever known understands that you need to talk about sin from time to time. And nobody resents a preacher for doing that. And what's more, generally speaking, properly preaching about sin, it gives people an encouragement to do better. And I think well-motivated people enjoy being given challenges and trying to do a little bit better. And as far as positive preaching goes, there's a group of people out there who like to preach about nothing but fluff and making people feel good. And I really don't have a lot of experience with Christians who like that kind of preaching, who want nothing but the positive aspects. I think most of us want a balance between those two things. Anyway, I saw that to say this. The sermon series that we've been engaged in this year about how our nation is going, what our culture is like, would probably, by most people, fit into the category of negative preaching. And I continue to be impressed and pleased with the way that this is coming across. Apparently, a lot of this is resonating with a lot of you and in a positive kind of way, and I appreciate that, and thank you for all the good comments. Maybe a little bit more than normal, and that's saying something with this group. This group is very, very positive. Even though it's negative preaching or whatever, people are receiving it well. Tonight, we're going to give the positive spin to the negative side, I suppose you could say. And it occurred to me while I was putting this lesson together, this may be the sermon that gets me in trouble. I may get in Dutch, as it were, with the positive sermon instead of the negative sermon. Now, I'll explain what I mean by that. I am firmly convinced, and I'm going to try to demonstrate over the next 30 minutes or so, that there are certain things going on in our culture that are very, very good, and that we are to be commended for, and we should commend ourselves for it, and strive to do better, of course. And we're going to give you some examples here. But the things that we're going to be talking about, I think that if your experience is like my experience, you're going to be very familiar with these concepts, except in our culture, these are the kind of things that we're being told over and over again are wrong with our culture. These are things that we're not doing right, the things that we're horribly failing at in various places, and that we ought to be ashamed of ourselves. And I want to kind of give the flip side to that here this evening. I want to emphasize that none of these things, we're going to be 100% on any of these things. There's always going to be room for improvement. There's always going to be things we ought to do better. And we ought not to be satisfied just because we happen to be doing better than you know, whatever culture or whatever time. But I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't believe that we should condemn ourselves because we're at 99% efficiency instead of 100% efficiency. We should be glad that we're doing what we're doing, and we should challenge ourselves to do better. And that's the case whether you're talking about an individual or a culture or what have you. But these are some things that I firmly believe. The United States of America in 2018 is doing better than any culture ever has at any point in history. And we should acknowledge that and appreciate that. I'll give you some examples here. The first one is respect for our physical inheritance. We are, and we talked about this a little bit this morning, we are given custody of this planet, of this world that we live in. And sometimes we do a good job with it, and sometimes we don't do a good job with it. Therefore, for several hundred years, or a couple hundred years at least, trying to make the most out of our existence on this earth resulted in some pretty ugly things happening. And pollution and dirt. And it's not too... Dirt is... I guess dirt's okay. I mean, God made the dirt. We ought to be happy with the dirt. But the filthiness of the world that we've created, it was appalling. I can remember in my lifetime when they started the anti-littering campaign. And some of you can remember this. It was not that long ago when littering was not that big a deal. You know, you go out on a picnic, you have the little picnic blanket, you got your paper wrappers and your paper cups and all this kind of thing, and after you're finished and everybody's happy, you put the kids back in the car, you throw the trash out in the grass, and you get back in the car. And that was it. Everybody did it. It was not that big a deal at all. Nobody gave it any thought. And in my lifetime, we have seen tremendous strides with regard to taking care of the things that we are given to us. And this is an important point, and it may not be the point that's most central to our salvation. I understand that. But at the same time, it's an expectation that God has always placed upon mankind, and we need to take it seriously. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. You know the text there, where after having been made in God's image, God gives us custody of the world. Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, subdue the earth. And various people have interpreted that in various ways, but what it basically boils down to is the world is given to you, and it is for your benefit, but you need to take care of it. You need to make sure that it's taking care of you. Make sure that you don't do more damage than you can undo, essentially. And we have gotten much, much better about that in our modern mechanized technological society. It's proper for us to use the world and its resources. I have no issue at all with exploiting the earth for whatever kind of resource might be available to us, whether it's some kind of fuel source or whether it's a metal or water or whatever it happens to be. God gave us these things. He gave them to us for a reason so that we could use them so we can enhance our life. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But abuse is a different kind of thing. And when our use of these things winds up being irresponsible, wasteful, dangerous, then we need to retrench and figure out exactly where we are. Jesus gives this analogy in a rather specific context in Luke 16, verses 10 through 12. He's talking there about stewardship of your money, really. But it's physical possessions in general. And that would include our planet. That would include the resources that we have at our disposal. And he says there, if you're not faithful in that which is another's, who's going to give you that which is your own? And he's talking in general terms about stewardship. You take care of the things that God has given to you, whether it's your own personal things that you have in your bank account or in your house, or whether it's talking about what he has given mankind in general as a legacy in a physical form. Our resources, the water, the land, the food, all these things. Whatever is given to us must be used responsibly as we serve him here in this life. Now, this can be taken too far. And lots of times, many, many times, including in pulpits, the topic of ecology comes up in such a way as to talk about how people take this too far and that we're essentially worshiping the earth and things of that nature. That's a very, very old concept, the idea of Mother Earth, as it were. Ancient concept, pagan concept. We don't want to go that far. We don't want to get to the point where we forget why we were given the earth in the first place. That God has made us, as we talked about this morning, masters of the universe. He's made us in his image. We are in charge of the world. But the things that he gives us are given to us so that we can remember who he is and who we are in response to him. We read from Psalm 19 a few moments ago. That we remember when we look at whether it's a starry sky or it's a field full of flowers or a beautiful mountaintop, whatever it happens to be. We are reminded of the glory of God and how marvelous it is to be part of his creation, let alone in charge of his creation, and then determined to be as responsible and dutiful and obedient in our stewardship as we possibly can be. Because God has created us along with everything else. And it is our responsibility to be the best thing that God ever created. That's why he made mankind, to stand apart, again, from creation, to be in charge of creation, to make sure that we, by choice, elevate God, worship God in our lives. And so it's our responsibility to stand up and applaud him with our lives, to make sure that we acknowledge him as the giver of every good and perfect gift. James describes it in such terms in James chapter 1 and verse number 16 through 18. He says there, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing given and every perfect gift
is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. God is blessing us, so not just so that we would be blessed, but so that we would be in position to honor God and glorify God in the things that we are doing. And if we are irresponsible with the things that he has given to us in stewardship, then again, that reflects upon our relationship with him. It reflects upon our general character and maybe points out issues that, although this may not be central to our relationship with Jesus Christ, it may indicate a character flaw that is reflected in other aspects. So, for what it's worth, let me give you, put a bug in your ear as far as these kind of things go. The job that God has given us as custodians of the world is a real job, and we need to take it seriously. By and large, our country is doing an exceptional job with this. Again, we're not perfect by any means. All the time you hear about polluted water and polluted air and things like that. And if you were to go back 100 years or go today across the world to China or someplace like that, you'd be astonished at how good of a job we are doing compared to other humans in other cultures. But we can do better and we ought to do better. All right, point number two is the tolerance for diversity of thought. And again, somebody may look at that and say, what kind of news has Hal been reading lately? That's exactly the opposite of what's going on in the world today. Nobody's tolerant of anything. Well, yes and no. There is certainly a sense, and maybe we're getting worse with regard to this instead of getting better in the last, whatever, this millennium anyway. Maybe. I don't know. But there certainly is a sense in which some people will hear something that is on the opposite side, and they will react maybe even violently, and war breaks out. But there is, I'm firmly convinced, a bell curve of tolerance in our world today. That we realize that there are people who are different than we are. And by and large, we're okay with that. You got the extremes over here on the one side, and then you got the bell curve, right? And it humps up like this and comes back, and now you got the extremes over on this side. And the people over on this side of the spectrum and the people on this side of the spectrum, they don't get along very well. And they try very hard, in fact, to stay away from each other. And when they do come in contact, they clash. But 90% of us are here in the middle. And in my experience, anyway, the 90% get along pretty good. I am constantly, you know, I hear about, you know, race relations and fights and all these kind of things. And I interact on a weekly basis with people of all sorts of different backgrounds, all kinds of different skin colors and national origins and things like that. You probably maybe a little bit more than I do. And I am struck that this kind of thing never comes up. Generally speaking, we acknowledge that the Democrats act like Democrats and the Republicans act like Republicans, the independents act like independents, and everybody just kind of goes their way, and we're okay with each other, by and large. And that is a good thing. I want to talk a little bit of how this applies to God's people and how this applies to people out there in the world. There is a diversity of thought among God's people. Different people have different cultures. Different people have different training and background and experiences. And they bring different outlooks to the people of God. And that can be a very, very good thing, as long as we know the difference between God's law and our own personal judgment. Now, we can get to the point where we are so convinced of our own judgment that we try to bind it on other people, and then we get into problems. Romans chapter 14 says we're not supposed to do that. Verse number 1. Do not, you know, be bound together, he says, but not for the purpose of enforcing your own opinions. I'm paraphrasing here a little bit. It's, if you think, and we have different philosophies, all kinds of different issues. I'm not going to get specific about that. You know what I'm talking about. Issues that do not relate directly to our salvation, do not relate directly to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, and then we've found ways to cooperate. We've found ways to disagree peacefully, to continue to discuss subjects, to stop discussing subjects, whatever might be appropriate under the circumstances, so that we can strive together in the unity of the faith, in the bond of peace. That's what Jesus wants for us, and that's what we want for ourselves. And when we find this diversity amongst ourselves, we don't panic. We don't, you know, freak out. We emphasize what we are as Christians, and we try to show what Paul calls the fruit of the Spirit. In Galatians chapter 5, the tail end of chapter 5 there in verse number 22 and following, what a Christian looks like, essentially, is described, and how a Christian behaves. The fruit of the Spirit is joy, is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things, there is no law. And it goes on to say, now those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. We skipped over the works of the flesh. We're getting rid of those things, and we're embracing the fruit of the Spirit. If we live by the Spirit, he says, let us also walk by the Spirit. Let us not become boastful, challenging one another, envying one another. And it's important to see that last verse there in the context of the work of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. The works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit. This is who we are as Christians. We are not boastful. We are not challenging one another. We're not envying one another. We're finding ways to cooperate amongst ourselves. Not in such a way as to deny the truth of the gospel by any means. But we do not want to elevate ourselves and our own opinions and our own philosophy to God's level or above the level of a brother or a sister in Christ. And again, by and large, I think that the church does this fairly well. We need some work on this, but by and large, in my experience anyway, we're getting it largely right. The same kind of thing works in the devil's world. As we're going about our daily activities and we're interacting with people who clearly do not share our philosophy. Maybe we just kind of infer that from the way they carry themselves. Maybe we infer that from the fact that they don't worship with us or whatever. Maybe it's on their t-shirt. I'm not a Christian and proud of it, you know, or whatever. What are we going to do about this? Well, we're going to go to war. That's what we're going to do. We're going to beat them over the head with the Bible until they succumb. Well, that's one approach. You can do it that way. Might I suggest another way? There might be a way for us to live in Satan's world, among Satan's representatives, in such a way as to be at peace, not only with ourselves, but with them. Now, realize that we're always going to be at war with the devil. We're always going to be at war, to a certain extent anyway, with the people of the devil. We understand that. There's always going to be friction. But it does not have to be rude. It does not have to be ugly in our dealings with one another. I really feel like, for some Christians, they want to be as ugly and off-putting as possible to people out there in the world so the people in the world will leave them alone. And if I don't have to interact with these people, then I don't have to teach them, I don't have to deal with them, they'll back off and I can just kind of go about my merry way. Well, that's not the way that we are told to interact with people in the world. We're supposed to save the people of the world. We're supposed to involve ourselves in their life and be compassionate and kind toward them. Not, again, not compromising the truth, but acknowledging that we are kindred spirits, we are brethren in Adam, and we owe one another some decency and common respect. And if we are expecting them to show us respect, if we're expecting them to show us kindness and decency and patience, then we ought to be willing to do the same thing for them. Backing up a little bit in Galatians chapter 5, verses 14 and 15. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, Paul writes. In the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, take care that you're not consumed with one another. Now he's talking here about brethren here. That when you have this spirit of animosity, the spirit of friction, and you foster it, and you encourage it, and you build this culture where people are fighting with one another all the time, you ought to be prepared at one point to wake up and deal with consequences. And although he's not talking about dealings with people in the world here, I think the same principle is going to apply. If we sustain and foster a culture where we are constantly at odds with people out there in the world, one day we're going to wake up with a knife in our back. Or a knife in somebody else's back, and we're going to be blamed for it. It's going to be an ugly kind of situation. We can do better than that. We need to do better than that. We need to be tolerant of one another. Again, not to compromise God's truth, but to show patience with one another as we're trying to work together. Do not allow, though, this compassion that we're showing to be confused with approval. This is where we kind of take it a step too far. I am so concerned about keeping the peace with my neighbors that I'm never going to talk to them about sin, never going to talk to them about Jesus, never going to talk to them about church. We're just going to kind of coexist, and then somehow, some way, he's going to come into my door in the middle of the night saying, I can tell you're a Christian and I'm not. My life is not right. Would you please tell me about Jesus Christ? Maybe that's happened to you. I don't know. Never happened to me. And I'm not holding my breath either. We do need to be compassionate. We do need to be patient. But as we interact with one another, we need to find a way to distinguish ourselves from the sin of the world. Ephesians chapter 5 tells us how we are lights in the world. representing the great light, Jesus Christ himself. Verse number 11 through 13 in chapter 5 reads, "Do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but indeed even expose them, for it is disgraceful even to speak of the things which are done by them in secret. But all things become visible when they are exposed to the light, for everything that becomes visible is light." That's going to be a lot harder, and it's been my experience, and your experience also, to find a way to interact with people who are living in sin, and perhaps even bragging about it, and be good neighbors, be kind-hearted, be supportive and encouraging on a certain level with these people, be a good neighbor to them, show love toward them, and yet have them appreciate, "I don't stand for what you stand for. The things that you're doing, I wish you wouldn't do them. You'd be better off if you didn't. I'd love to show you a better way." That's a very difficult balance to strike. You know, in the past, though, I've managed to maintain friendships with homosexuals. I've managed to maintain friendships with adulterers and such. I'm sure you probably have, too. Not because I told them they were okay where they were, but because I told them I loved them where they were. And they can see the attitude and see the difference between someone who is hateful and someone who simply hates sin. That is a difficult balance to strike, obviously. But we can and we need to do exactly that. Well, that's the second point. Let me give you one more point, and then we'll close. I want to talk a little bit about what I'm calling here the unity of the human experience. And I'm always criticizing social media. I'm always criticizing the internet, it seems like, when I get up here. I want to talk a little bit about the positive. Shortly after I got on Facebook, I started collecting friends from all over the world, which is really kind of a pointless exercise and maybe a little bit self-serving, I don't know. But it struck me immediately how remarkable it was that people, and particularly Christians, from all over the place were interested, at least on some level, in my life and in my work. What a remarkable thing it was to have a friend, and we use the term loosely here, but a friend in Taiwan, or a friend in the Philippines, or in communist China, or in deepest Africa, all over the world, touching the lives, however shallowly we're touching them, but making a connection with people and realizing that there are human beings in other places, places that I will never go, people that I will never meet, but nevertheless are real, every bit as real as I am, going through the same things I'm going through, having the same trials that I'm going through, maybe with a little bit more money or a little less money, maybe a little more comfort or less comfort or whatever, but still human beings. And that ultimately we're the same in all of this. That's a remarkable kind of thing when you think about it. And a level of connection that we share with people on the other side of the world that other generations simply did not because they could not. Unless they were in the military or in some kind of travel situation where they just went all over the place for their work or whatever, airline stewardesses or something. Most of the time, we lived in our little world. The story goes back in the 150 years ago or so, in London, most people in London never left a 4-square block radius. Never. They would live to an average age of whatever, 40 or 50, however long people lived back then. And they would never leave that area. They would never see anybody else. People who lived their entire life in England had never heard of England, let alone other countries. Never heard of the ocean. Never heard a foreign language in their life. Their world was just right there. That was all they knew. And we're not like that anymore. We realize that we have connections with real human beings all over the place. Paul says, "Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep." I was rejoicing with Brother Manguinyana this last week in Zimbabwe. Things are going well. I mean, we didn't have a deep conversation, but we talked a little bit at least. Things are going great here. Things are going great here. Well, we're praying for you. We're praying for you. That's great. And that was more or less it. But that matters. That's significant that we were able to connect with people in other areas on this kind of level that have nothing to do with native tongue or skin color or philosophy or any of these other things. Realizing that we are all one race. I really hate the word racist or what race a person is. I'm fully convinced there's only one race of humans. That's the human race. We have various ethnicities. We have various skin colors. We have various national languages. But there's only one race. We're all human beings. And we appreciate that more and more as we start getting to know each other a little bit better. I thought about a second topic along these lines, talking about the horrors of war, that we're more horrified by warfare in the modern day than we ever have been. And I think that's true. I think that's valid. But it kind of goes along with what we're talking about here. 100 years ago, if 100 people died in communist China, or 100 million people, rather, died in communist China, we didn't care. Not because we were insensitive people, because we didn't know about it. And there was no way we could have known about it. And even if we did somehow hear some story about some people in some place, it was easily dismissed because we had no contact with these people. We were living in a very, very different world now, where the plight of people in various parts of the world is real. If there's a tsunami in the Philippines, or if there's an earthquake in Japan, or if there's a regime change in Nigeria, it matters to us because we are more connected with our fellow man than we ever have been in times past. And we serve as the opportunity presents itself. Just because you know about, you know, war in Rwanda, or what, that doesn't mean you have to go enlist on the side of right, or figure out what the side of right is, first of all, and then go enlist. We're not suggesting that. But as you have opportunity to help in certain situations, especially with regard to our brethren, then we need to take advantage of our opportunities, such as they are. And we talked about Brother Manguinyana a few moments ago. And many of us have been privileged to assist in his endeavors in various places. Financial relief for evangelistic reasons, for humanitarian reasons. It's a blessing that we're given an opportunity to do that. It's kind of sort of like the people in Paul's day when he was collecting for the needy saints there in Jerusalem. And he talks to the Corinthians about it in chapter 9 in 2 Corinthians. He emphasizes this as our role in dealing with especially brethren in foreign locations. Now, he who supplies, God, of course, who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in everything for all liberality through which through us is producing thanksgiving to God. For the ministry of this service is not only fully supplying the needs of the saints, but is also overflowing through many thanksgivings to God. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they will glorify God for your obedience to your confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution to them and to all, while they also by prayer on your behalf yearn for you because of the surpassing grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for his indescribable gift. That word gift there refers back to the supplying seed to the sower and bread for food in verse number 10. God gives you opportunities, not just physical opportunities. That's the language that he uses here. But it's not physical food he's talking about here primarily, is it? It's your life. He has blessed you in such a way to allow you to either focus on completely and totally blessing yourself or finding somebody else to bless. And if God empowers you in this area, there's also an obligation there. And as we pursue that obligation, we have confidence that God sees us and that God will give us far more in return than we are giving out to others. We see that in spiritual returns. We see that in emotional returns. God sees what we are doing, and he holds up our hands while we do it. Now, all that being said, it's important for us to use righteous judgment. John 7:24, judge not according to appearances, judge righteous judgment. There have been a lot of scams. There's a lot of fakery. There's a lot of cheating going on here. I'm not suggesting the next person comes and knocks on your door and asks to give some kind of charity in some, you know, third world country, then you absolutely let me empty my bank account. I'm not suggesting that. You need to use some judgment with regard to this. That being said, we cannot allow good judgment to stand as a euphemism for cynicism. Just because we're afraid that our goodness is going to be taken advantage of, that doesn't mean we stop being good. That doesn't mean we give up on our fellow human beings. That's what love is, right? And again, yes, use good judgment. But at a certain point, we love our neighbor as ourselves. We're going to start have to look like we love them. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 7, you know the text, right? Love believes all things, bears all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Maybe if we give $5 to the next homeless person that we see, and we follow him home, and it turns out he lives in a 2,000 square foot house, and he's, you know, got all kinds of accoutrements, he's got satellite TV and all that kind of thing, and we feel awful because we've been humiliated and taken advantage of, maybe, just maybe, losing $5 isn't the end of the world. That maybe there are bigger issues involved in that, and maybe the next person that we come across who needs help actually does need help. Yes, you use good judgment, absolutely. And the giving to homeless people is a whole other situation I'm not going to get into. But let's not quit on our fellow man. Let's not quit being loving and supporting just because it doesn't always work out for us. Just because in our judgment, they are not always deserving of this. We weren't deserving. And God loved us anyway. Well, we have developed a culture, a society, where it has become much, much easier for us to interact on behalf of our fellow man. You know, GoFundMe campaigns and all sorts of different situations. Like in the flood in Houston, maybe you heard about some of this. There are people that I had some acquaintance with put up a GoFundMe page. Hey, here's a way that you can help. And I didn't have to get in my car. I didn't have to go to the bank. I could just send some money and it was done. What a wonderful thing that is. And we can go on and on with examples of this. But the point is that we have an opportunity to show our love in a way that we never have before. And we're doing it, and good for us. Let's continue to do that, not grow weary in well-doing. Anyway, that is the lesson for the evening. I hope that it has been useful and helpful and challenging to you and your understanding of the way things operate in our society, what our opportunities are to serve in that society. And again, don't grow weary in well-doing. Yes, we're doing a very good job in many, many areas. Let's try to do a little bit better. If there's any way we can help you in a spiritual way, if there's any way that we can help bring you closer to Jesus Christ, whether that's by welcoming you into fellowship, by helping you into the water of baptism, having your sins washed away, as Jesus himself said, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. If you're ready to do that, if you're ready in some other kind of way to lean on your brethren for help and encouragement in some moral way, we would be thrilled to offer you whatever encouragement we possibly can. If there's whatever we can do, whatever assistance we can render, please respond as we stand and sing at this time to encourage.